It's Friday, December 3rd, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview.
Will the gentleman from New York, Mr. Rangel, kindly appear in the well? By its adoption of House Resolution 1737, the House has resolved that Representative Charles Rangel of New York be censured.
With those somber words, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, called Representative Charles B. Rangel to the well of the House in order to read the bill of censure. This was the first time in almost 30 years that the House of Representatives had censured one of its members, taking the step which is just one short of the most dramatic action taken by the House, which is expulsion. It was in 1983 when a member of the House was last censured, and there have only been 22 members of the House that have been censured prior to Representative Rangel. Thus, what we witnessed on Thursday as Americans is a sober but necessary reminder that our public representatives are indeed accountable. But there is so much to this story. Representative Rangel was accused of using his office in order to raise funds illicitly, in order to take advantage of rent-suppressed apartments, and to raise funds for a center in his honor at a local university, raising those funds from corporations and individuals that had interest before Congress. Now, what is really interesting about all of this, of course, is that the Congress, the House of Representatives in this case, was required to discipline one of its own members. As the Washington Post reports, the decision on Thursday came after 2.5 years of pleading and $2 million in legal fees paid by Representative Rangel. This doesn't take into account the cost of the investigation undertaken by Congress, the actions of its Ethics Committee, nor the preoccupation of the Congress in dealing with these ethical issues when there was pressing national business that should have had first concern. There was an almost Shakespearean quality to the tragedy of Thursday. Representative Rangel was first elected to Congress 20 years ago, representing an impoverished neighborhood of Harlem. He has been a fixture in Democratic politics at the national level ever since, and he finally rose to his greatest political ambition, which was chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee back in 2007. But shortly after arriving at that chairmanship, the ethics issues arose that led him first to resign temporarily as chairman, then permanently, and finally to stand in the well of the House of Representatives on Thursday and to have a clearly nervous Speaker Nancy Pelosi read the 45-second case against him as adopted overwhelmingly by the House. That vote, by the way, was 333-79 voting for censure. Over the last several weeks, and especially in the most recent days, Representative Rangel had tried to persuade his colleagues not to vote for censure, but to go for a lesser charge against him. Now, as we look at this as Christians, we come to see a great deal of what we already know about humanity played out in this situation. First, the reality of individual sin. There can be absolutely no doubt that Representative Rangel was found guilty of very serious accusations, and he was found guilty by his peers, first those on the House Ethics Committee and those in the full House of Representatives. But if you listen closely to what Representative Rangel had to say before, during, and after this judgment, you come to understand that he still is not accepting personal responsibility for grievous wrongdoing. He accepted that the charges were serious, but as he spoke, he blamed most of the culpability on his staff and on a very busy life and on the complexities of office. Now, we should come to expect this. We come to understand that sinners seek to deny the sinfulness of their sin. That's a part of the complicity of sin. We see it in this case in Representative Rangel, but in many other cases, we see it in the mirror as we seek to do something similar ourselves. We seek to avoid what comes with sin, which is shame. The action undertaken by the House of Representatives by calling Representative Rangel to the well, as he stood before his colleagues, by the way, the 22 previous men who had stood in the well to be censured by the House faced the House. Representative Rangel, with his hands clasped, faced the Speaker. But nonetheless, as he stood there, he was shamed by his colleagues. He was asked if he felt the shame. He turned to the one who asked and asked if the man was a psychiatrist. In other words, Charles Rangel is still Charles Rangel, as he said. He is not going to answer the question. But we seek to avoid the shame, and one of the realities of human sinfulness is that we compound our sinfulness through rationalization and through a conspiracy to try to avoid seeing our sin for what it is. But Christians also see a larger picture here. They see an attempt at human justice, or at least some attempt on the part of the House of Representatives to protect its own ethical character. And so what you saw in this process, drawn out over 2.5 years of legal and procedural and political maneuvering, was the House of Representatives seeking to do the minimum possible to be seen publicly as taking the issue with great seriousness. Now, let's be honest about what we're looking at here. It could be the House of Representatives in this case. It could be a local church failing at the task of church discipline in another. The reality is that many of these members of the House chose to act in a way that required the forcing of their hand. And the reason for this is quite easily understood. Every member of the House of Representatives looking at Charlie Rangel in the well understood that he or she could, under very similar circumstances, find himself or herself standing there. That's a sobering reality. Christians look at this and understand the institutional dimension of human sinfulness. New Orthodox theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, back in the middle of the 20th century, wrote a major work entitled Moral Man and Immoral Society. His argument is that human sinfulness is basically located at the institutional level and that individual human beings become sinful primarily through their complicity with those institutions. Evangelicals tend to see it exactly the other way around. We understand that both individuals and societies are immoral. We do concede with Mr. Niebuhr that institutions can bring out ever heightened concentrations of human evil, but the problem with human institutions being sinful is that their sinfulness is rooted in the sinfulness of individual human beings. Americans viewing the scene of Representative Rangel standing in the well of the House receiving the censure must have felt the awful weight of that censure, its shame, and its impact. But Christians looking at that picture should imagine a picture of far greater horror, and that is of the sinner standing in the well of the divine court of justice facing the holy judge. The big question then is how we will make our plea. Before that court, only the righteousness of Christ will suffice. Today's edition of the Wall Street Journal includes a very important op-ed article written by Marvin Heyer and Abraham Cooper of the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles. Entitled Presbyterians Against Israel, this article gets to something that has been off the screen of many Americans and even most American Christians. There has been a hardening of positions on the part of liberal Christians in America toward the state of Israel. Now, one of the interesting things to note over the past several decades is that there have been a confluence of political and even theological interests among American more secular Jews and more secular denominations on the Christian side, that is, the denominations of liberal Protestantism. In terms of many political and theological currents, they have found a good deal of common cause. As a matter of fact, Rabbis Heyer and Cooper mentioned that in many ways, the second half of the 20th century was a high point for Jewish-Christian relations. But something has changed, and that something has to do with the fact that liberal Christian denominations, the old Protestant mainline, have been moving aggressively into a posture of opposition to the state of Israel. Rabbis Heyer and Cooper document this in their article published in today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. They point to the 2007 action undertaken by the World Council of Churches in adopting the document Churches Together for Peace and Justice in the Middle East. That conference produced the Amman Call, a document that condemned violence, according to these rabbis, and endorsed a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but denied Israel's right to a future as a Jewish state. They moved from the Amman Call in their op-ed to the 2008 action, also by the World Council of Churches, which, in terms of that action, instructed Christians to understand all biblical references to Israel only metaphorically. Then they jumped to 2009, when the World Council of Churches put on its website a document known as the Kairos Palestine Document. As the rabbis explain, the document calls for a general boycott of Israel and argues that Christians' faith requires them to side with the oppressed, meaning the Palestinians. It speaks of the evils of the Israeli occupation, yet is silent on any evils committed by Palestinians, including the Hamas terrorists, who now govern the Gaza Strip. End quote. Now, I'll read this article with great interest. On the part of conservative American Christians, many are dispensationalists who have a biblical and theological rationale for seeing the state of Israel in its present form as a fulfillment of biblical prophecy. But beyond that, Most evangelical Christians, even non-dispensationalists, understand a very important purpose for Israel. Most understand the continuation of God's promises in some form to the spiritual nation of Israel and some political manifestation of those promises. All of these things require on the part of evangelicals a special allegiance with the Jewish people and, in the case of Israel, a special interest in preserving the Israeli state as many evangelical theologians understood it mid-century, a vessel for the containment of the Jewish people, even for the eventual proclamation of the gospel. Now, how do we account for the movement of liberal Christians in the United States, especially these liberal denominations, against Israel? Well, they, number one, do not feel bound by any biblical concern for Israel. Number two, they no longer hold out any gospel evangelism for the Jewish people, instead adopting a two-covenant theology that suggests that there is no need for Christ on the part of the Jewish people. And third, they have basically tied themselves to almost every radical cause and insurgency movement, especially as you see in the actions taken by the World Council of Churches over the last three or four decades. You add all that together, and there is good cause for Rabbis Heyer and Cooper to be very concerned, and indeed for the leaders of the Jewish state of Israel to be very concerned about where liberal Christian denominations are going in terms of their understanding of the state of Israel. But what is not stated in this article is of equal importance. If you speak to major Jewish authorities, and especially to Israeli leaders who will speak honestly, they will tell you that they are very concerned not only about liberal Protestant denominations, but about the softening of support for Israel, undertaken now on the part of many liberal Jews in America as well. Many Jewish organizations are softening their support for Israel, and that, added to the total picture, means that we are watching some very interesting developments. So who in the end are left as the friends of Israel? Well, those friends are fewer in number, it seems, in every generation, but interestingly enough, Israeli leaders increasingly acknowledge evangelical Christians as the friends who continue to stand with them. On the other side of this equation, many of these same evangelicals are awakening to the fact that many of our own Christian brothers and sisters are living on the Palestinian side of this equation. Thus, this is going to require a great deal of very serious, very careful theological and biblical thought on the part of American evangelicals. And it looks like now it's about time. Finally, the cover story of Time magazine released early this morning is this. Do you want to know a secret? It has to do, of course, with the release of so many classified documents by WikiLeaks in the last several days and the aftermath of the controversies that have ensued. But for Christians, the big angle here, at least one of those angles, is the reality of secrecy, the need for secrecy, and a culture in which the lie is often expected. That'll give us all a lot to talk about next week. And I'll meet you again on Monday for The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. This morning, you'll see posted a new article entitled The Knowledge of the Self-Revealing God, Starting Point for the Christian Worldview. You can also follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. And for information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again on Monday for The Briefing.